All right. It didn't occur to me until Richard just said it now that that could be interpreted as what the bleep is quantum information. Who saw the movie What the Bleep? Okay. So I haven't seen it, so I can't really comment on it. I have a strong opinion, though, that you should probably not pay too much attention to it. I didn't see it because I wasn't sure that I was prepared to feel the pain. In designing a keynote talk, I thought, well, I could talk about this, I could talk about that, or what the heck, I could try to talk about everything. So I'm going to try to cover the general 100% of what the heck is quantum information science. And so I wrote out a talk about this, and then I realized it was 700 slides long, and I decided I needed to chop out one or two. So instead, I'm going to hit some of the interesting things about quantum information science. And since I chopped out most of those slides, we have a little bit of extra time. This shouldn't be rushed or hurried. In particular, I want to ask you very sincerely to stop me and ask questions whenever you feel like it. This is not a respect issue. You don't need to put your hand up like this in the back and wait until I see you. If you have a question or want to ask more about something, or if I haven't been clear to you personally, even if you think maybe the people around you understand it, but you don't, please just say, "Excuse me, question." Everybody cool with that? Okay, good. I like to see the nodding. Excellent. You can disagree with all the content of my talk, but this stuff you should agree with. Okay. Quantum information science is what I do. Quantum information, quantum computation, quantum technology, if you will. And there's three words here: quantum information and science. And so you might think I'd start with quantum and then move on to information and then on to science. And actually, I'm going to do it the other way around. I'm going to start with information because this is the core of what we do. So first question is, what does information theory do? What is information theory? Then I'm going to go and I'm going to explain how quantum makes this different. In fact, the only real pedagogical content of this talk, the only point where you want to turn on your I'm learning something sensors, you don't have to. There's not going to be a test on this. But the only point where I'm really going to try to explain something in detail is where I'm going to explain what makes quantum mechanics different from not quantum mechanics, a little bit about quantum states, et cetera. And then the rest of this is really going to be cool stuff and explanations about what kind of stuff we do. So without further ado, what's information theory? Well, there's a bunch of parts to information theory. One of the big ones, the real defi- Yes. Excellent question. Now I go, oh man, hard question. Pedagogical refers to teaching. So when I say that's the pedagogical content, that's the point where I'm going to try to be a pedagogue, which is sort of like a demagogue. But not like a pedophile, thank you very much. Not at all. Did I just violate the harassment policy by even mentioning that word? Okay. So a pedagogue is someone who teaches. And in other words, the pedagogical part is the part where I'm actually trying to, explain and teach bit by bit. The rest of it, I'm just really telling stories, cool stuff about quantum information theory. Thank you for the question. So information theory is centered around communication theory. Really, this was born in about the 1940s during World War II. A guy named Claude Shannon essentially single-handedly invented the field. So what does communication theory do for us? Here's one example. It lets us use GPS satellites. Can I get a show of hands, anybody who's ever used a GPS of one sort or another? Cool. I was sort of terrified that actually this was going to turn out to be so 2006 or something, and nobody actually used GPS anymore. So GPS satellites. So here's the GPS cluster. The idea is we got a whole crap load of satellites. I think there's 24 or maybe 48 of them that are in interlocking orbits. They make a nice symmetric pattern around the Earth. So the satellites are going around and around, and at any point on the Earth's surface and any time during the day, you can turn on a little receiver that's maybe the size of this pointer, and you can lock on to half a dozen of these satellites. You need four of them, but five work a lot better. By the way, the reason you... Okay, well, question. Why do you have to lock on to four GPS satellites to get a fix on where you are? So they all tell you different things. Why four?
Because it's triangulation, and then you need another extra one because you're on a curved surface.
Pretty much. So the simplest answer, you get like 95% on that. You are doing essentially triangulation. The simplest answer is because space-time has four dimensions. You need to find out where you are in X, where you are in Y, where you are in Z, because the surface of the Earth goes up and down, and where you are in time. And if you're uncertain about any of those, then it turns out that you're uncertain about all of them. So that's why you have to get four satellites. And then the extra ones beyond that add redundancy, which is going to be a concept that's going to come up in just a minute. You've got more data, and so you can sort of run internal consistency checks. So this is why if you're using a GPS, you can be locked onto three satellites just great, and it still tells you I have no idea where you are. Okay, so here's all these satellites. I turn on my receiver. The GPS satellites show up. I'm communicating with them somehow. They're sending me down a signal that tells me, in sum, where I am. Now, this is actually sort of amazing that this works. The reason it's amazing is because this is what a GPS satellite looks like. So what do you see on the GPS satellite? What's that? Yeah. You see solar panels. What are they there for? Exactly. This is how it powers itself. There's really only two ways to power a satellite or any kind of spacecraft. One of them is solar panels. What's the other one? Nuclear isotopes. You can't actually put a full nuclear reactor in there. But what you can do is you can put a radioactive source that either gives off heat that is turned to a radiothermal generator, or you can use more esoteric technology where the electrons coming off of the source are actually stripped and turned directly into current. But as far as I know, almost all the modern ones use radiothermal because you can use the heat much more efficiently. There is one, so this is great if you're sending, you know, interplanetary probes that are going out to Neptune or something. What's the problem with radiothermal generation in satellites? You run out, but that takes a long time. The pioneers are still going pretty strong. Fire away.
Any accident happened, yeah, you got a problem.
If you've got half a kilo of thorium in that thing and it blows up on launch, it sucks to be in the debris path. Actually, there's worse things that could happen, frankly, but we as a society are paranoid about radioactivity. There are seriously worse things that could happen. Actually, some of the chemical propellants are a lot worse. But we're paranoid about radioactivity, and so it's politically incorrect to send up radioisotopes. So back to the main point. Okay, solar panels. The solar panels, you'll notice, are about the same size as the satellite. This is where the satellite is getting all of its energy from. It uses that energy to send radio signals down to Earth, which your GPS receiver catches. Now, are those narrow beam radio signals or wide beam radio signals? Wide. Wide. Say, wide area. Why do they have to cover a wide area? Use less satellites. Better reason. So imagine here we've got this cluster of satellites, and each one of them is sending a, you know, like a laser beam, narrow beam down to Earth.
They can overlap easier.
Yeah, but the point is, anywhere on Earth, you're supposed to be able to get a GPS fix. Each one of these satellites has to cover the whole Earth. So, a bit of elementary physics reasoning. I've got power coming in from the sun. It's being converted through converters that have less than 100% efficiency into usable electrical power, and then converted by a transmitter into a beam that covers the whole Earth, right? What else is covering the whole Earth?
Atmosphere.
The atmosphere? Sunlight. The sun's radiation, an incredibly tiny percentage of which is hitting these solar panels, is also blanketing the entire Earth. Now think about this. You're capturing the amount that hits these solar panels, and then you're turning that into a different kind of energy, and you're broadcasting it over the whole Earth. What's the ratio of power between the sun and the satellite? Now, the sun, by the way, in case you were wondering, doesn't just beam yellow light. It beams all colors of light and also beams all radio frequencies. The peak of the sun's power, random question, anybody know where the peak of the sun's power is? What's that?
The center.
The center, okay. So Thank you for pointing out that I asked a really badly phrased question. The sun broadcasts at lots of wavelengths and frequencies. At what frequency, what wavelength, what color is the sun's power spectrum maximal? Where does it have the most power? Anybody want to guess randomly? What's that? Could be. Any other guesses?
Same with the GPS
satellites? That would be bad. But actually, we can design the GPS satellites. So we're not that dumb. So actually, you can figure this out using anthropic reasoning. The peak of the sun's power spectrum is right in the middle of what we can see. Convenient, right? Mm-hmm. Except we evolved to be at the peak of the sun's power spectrum. If we, yes?
Why would it be bad for the sun to have its max power the same as the satellites?
So the idea is that the amount of noise on that frequency is the amount of power that the sun is dumping into that frequency. So if you're intelligent and you're designing a GPS satellite, you pick an area of the electromagnetic spectrum where the sun is not too loud and noisy. Right? So if there was a bunch of really high frequency noise in this room, you know, a screaming baby or something, I have one of those, then I might talk in a deep voice. As opposed to a high voice like this, which would get drowned out by the baby. So that's why it would be a problem. So we design it otherwise. But evolution has, if you will, designed us, oh man, I'm going to get in trouble for that one, so that we see at the peak of the sun's power spectrum. It's actually about green. So it looks yellow to us for complicated reasons, but really the peak is at green. So at the GPS frequency, the sun is not putting out the most power, but it's still putting out a lot more power than this satellite. So how the heck do we ever lock on to these tiny little weak sources out in the middle of this giant noise bath? The answer is we use information theory and we use communication theory, which is all about how to communicate even though there is noise going on. So anybody want to take a wild guess at how the GPS satellites manage to to break through this noise even though they're weaker by a factor of thousands than the sun? Pardon me? Ooh, cool answer. Not right, but cool. All right. So, roughly speaking, give me a Luddite here and break out the old chalk. Here's a somewhat crude explanation of what's going on. The sun is putting out random white noise. So what I'm going to look at is the amplitude of what your receiver sees on the GPS frequency, which is, I don't know, pick a number, 1 gigahertz or something like that. So we're tuned in to 1 gigahertz frequency, a billion cycles a second, and what we see is almost entirely due to the sun. White noise looks like that. So what does the satellite do to break through that? It cannot overpower this noise. If it could overpower the noise, then I could just send a really big signal that looked like this. You add those two together, and what you would see is, right? And then you could obviously break out the signal. You know, you could send an up for a 1 bit and a negative voltage for a 0 bit. But you can't do this because we can't overpower it. So what they do is they send a carrier frequency that's maybe a megahertz, a million cycles per second, so substantially slower than the actual frequency of the electromagnetic wave. And it looks like this, this wave that I already put up. Sorry. It just goes on, you know, a million of these per second. And then they modulate this very slightly over time. So what they do is if they want to send a 0 bit, they'll take out of these, you know, billions and billions of cycles, they'll cut out a few of them so that in this period it goes flat for a while. Now, how does receiver pick out this signal, which is totally swamped by the noise? The receiver knows that the sender is going to be sending at this megahertz modulation frequency, And so what it does is it integrates the product. It takes this signal, the noisy signal that it gets, right, which is totally wiped out. I'll call that F of t. This is electromagnetic voltage as a function of time, and it's jittering up and down in your receiver. And it multiplies this by the perfect ideal modulation frequency. So I'll call this F sub 1 megahertz, right, which is just a periodic function. Multiplies these two together, and then it integrates them over a long period of time. And it turns out that if the satellite is sending a steady wave for, say, a microsecond, millisecond, actually, sorry, I need to get my time scale straight, then this becomes some positive number. In other words, we get some net voltage. And if the satellite is not sending, then there's no periodic background within the noise to pull out. And so this turns out to be zero, right? So what we've done is, by repeating, essentially what the satellite is doing is it's repeating its statement over and over again. It's saying, yes, I'm sending, for a long period of time. And by locking into that frequency, the receiver can pull out the answer to a one-bit question, which is the satellite transmitting or not? And therefore, can communicate information at actually a fairly high rate. So this is the simplest possible picture. And I've just tried to give a general idea of how you can communicate through a tremendous amount of noise. This is the central question of communication theory. We want to know how to transmit information, meaningful information, through noisy channels, of which this is a primo example. Now, you say, well, that's cool. Maybe there's another technique with a more complicated modulation that would let me transmit even more information, right? And that way, I could not only use the GPS for position location, but I could download YouTube videos from it as well, which would be probably boost the sales of GPS units. So the next thing that communication theorists did after they figured out how to send information using error-correcting codes, this is an example of what's called a repetition code, because very simple, you just say the same thing over and over and over again. You ever do this with your folks? Just like, And eventually, even if they miss some of them, the message gets through. Now, okay, actually, it doesn't work, I know. But my daughter does this all the time. She says the same thing over and over again, and I just smile and gurgle at her, despite whatever, I don't know what she's saying. Sorry. So the example of a repetition code, but there might be more sophisticated things that you can do. Maybe we can get better and better and better. So the second thing that information theorists did is they figured out that you can calculate an upper bound on the total amount of information that you can put through. This is called the capacity of a channel. So the channel here is the electromagnetic waves going from the satellite down to my receiver. And once I've characterized that physically, this is where the physics comes in, I can calculate the maximum amount of information. This is kind of cool, that in fact there is such a number that tells you, you may not communicate more information than this. Don't bother. It's kind of like the speed of light, right? It's useful to know that the speed of light is an absolute limit, and we really shouldn't spend too much time trying to travel faster than the speed of light unless we want to get into wormholes and weird stuff like that. So these are the sort of questions that communication theory covers. First big branch of information theory. Pause. Deep breath. Any questions before I move on? Okay, you can always come back to this. What else do information theorists do? One of the core things we do is we study computation. So this sounds like computer science, and it is computer science, but it's a branch of information theory. Computation is how we transform information from one form into another. So here's an example. I might take information that specifies two numbers, right? These would be, I could write these out in binary notation, and these would be integers. So I've got two long strings of bits, and I can just stick those end to end and make it one long string of bits that represents two numbers. And then I could do a computation that turns that information into a different bit string, which is the product of those two numbers. Useful thing, my computer is doing it at least millions, possibly billions of times per second as we speak. So the question of how do you generate that transformation, how do you write an algorithm that does that, is information theoretic. Another example, anytime you download a web page, right? Really, what comes to your computer is a bunch of HTML. And your computer figures out how to turn that into a different form of information, which is to say pixels on your screen. So rendering is another general type of algorithm. One that's near and dear to my heart is simulation. So here, for physics simulations, I start with some information which describes, for instance, a bunch of random gas atoms and the law of either Einsteinian or Newtonian gravity. And this is, you can write this stuff out. You can write out all the positions of the gas atoms. Pretty easy if they're just randomly distributed. And you can write out Newton's laws. And then you want to turn a crank that will turn these into something cool like galaxy formation. So, for instance, this is a 250 million particle simulation of the accretion of dark matter around the Milky Way galaxy to form a galactic halo. So what you're looking at here is, did Mark Wyman or anybody else cover redshift and what Z means? Okay. It's a way of measuring how old, how far back in time you are. So what we're looking at here is a redshift of about 12, which means we are so far, the idea here is that stuff that is further away from us, if something is millions of light years away, then what we're seeing is actually what it looked like a million years in the past, right? Now, a million is diddly squat here. If you go billions of light years away, then you're seeing into the deep past. But because the universe is expanding, that stuff is also moving away from us. So it's an iron law. If it's far away, we're seeing its past, and it is moving away from us. And if it's moving away from us, it gets redshifted, which is to say the light from it becomes more and more red. This is so far in the past that the light from this stuff, if we could see it, would be redshifted by a factor of 12, which is to say all the way down into the, like visible light would be all the way down into the infrared. This is way in the past. This is what we think the universe looked like as is a horribly complex initial condition. And the simulation, the algorithm these people ran was simply what happened starting I don't know how many billion years ago. So we're also zooming in at the same time. We're zooming in space. We're also moving forward in time, as you can see up here. And what you're seeing here is clumps of dark matter evolving, not in real time, much faster than that, orbiting around each other and accreting into a galactic halo. This simulation is called the Via Lactea, which is Latin for Milky Way. And the point is, this isn't actually the Milky Way. It's just something that somebody thought was a good representation of what's actually going on with the Milky Way. And now what we're doing is we're zooming out, and this is static. No time evolution going on. This is the present day, supposedly. And now we're just looking at this. And ponder for just a moment the variety of different algorithms that are going on in an information processing sense. First, to compute the time evolution of a model of our galaxy, and then to display all of this stuff in 3D, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a heck of a lot of information theory going on to enable us to do modern physics, to give lectures about modern physics, and to just make cool, pretty pictures. Good pause. Any questions or anything? OK, so that's an example of an algorithm. Final example I'm going to give of information processing algorithm is something called factoring. Now, this is actually, I'm given a number, but I'm promised this is the product of two other numbers. What are those numbers? So it's just the reverse of multiplication, right? So whenever you can do an algorithm, you can generally do it backwards as well. Now, a very, very, very deep statement about the world that we live in, and I don't just mean our technological world, I mean the universe that we live in, is that some problems are harder than others. We have a notation in computer science for specifying this. It's called big O notation. What this means is that as these numbers get bigger and bigger, as they get very big, if the number of bits that describe the numbers is n, n might be 1,000, it might be a million, but you want to multiply 2 million digit numbers. How long does it take, in terms of computer cycles, to multiply 2 million digit numbers? The answer is, it takes approximately, computer scientists are big on approximation, so really, this is just the most important part. It's the part that becomes that dwarfs everything else as n gets really big. Approximately n times the logarithm of n. So to base 10 at least, the logarithm is the number of digits in a number. If n is a million, there are 6 digits. So the amount of time in terms of computer cycles is approximately 6 million. If you were to take a billion digit number, it would take a billion times the log of a billion, or about 9 billion. Lesson here is that that logarithmic factor there is much less important than the linear factor of n. So the best known multiplication algorithms are about take n log n time. Rendering a web page just takes order n, because it's pretty simple. You just march through the HTML code, right? If there's n bytes of HTML, you basically just have to scan through it and do something at each step. So that algorithm is a little bit faster than that one. These are all pretty easy. The simulation algorithm is actually order n squared. So for a million particles, this takes a trillion time steps. For a billion particles, this takes a quintillion time steps. This is getting fairly bad. That's why they only use 250 million particles, because 250 million squared is a long time. That actually took several months on a supercomputer cluster to run that simulation. So this problem is harder than these problems. What about factoring? Well, this is an interesting one. This is a little bit complicated. Order e to the cube root of n. Open question. Is this, heuristically speaking, bigger or smaller than this? So this is kind of a weird function. For the moment, if you want to understand it, for just a moment, forget the cube root business here. Just ignore it. E to the n grows really fast with n. Every time n goes up by 1, the size of e to the n gets multiplied by 2.7 or so. So this grows exponentially. E to the cube root of n grows slower than e to the n, but it still, and here's the key thing, grows not only faster than n squared, it grows faster than n cubed, and the fourth, and to the 1912th. It grows faster than n to any power. And so computer scientists draw a big distinction between things that grow as some power of the problem size. We call those algorithms efficient and those problems easy. And things that grow as the exponential of some function of the problem size. And those are hard problems. And the fascinating thing is that as far as we know, multiplying two numbers is easy, and factoring two numbers, just reversing that multiplication, is hard. This is what's called a one-way function. You can do it, but you can't undo it. Sort of like Humpty Dumpty, right? Breaking Humpty Dumpty, trivial. Putting Humpty Dumpty back together again is trouble, even for all the king's horses and all the king's men. This is going to be relevant later on. Okay, so brief survey of computation and what the heck it is. Let me mention one more type of information theory, cryptography. So this is what you do back in third grade when you've got a secret and you want to tell your friend on the other side of the classroom, but you don't want the teacher to find out. You want to communicate secretly without anybody finding out. So there are various ways of doing this. As you can imagine, this is big business these days. We care a lot about this. Governments care a lot about this. Companies care a lot about this. People who own credit cards and buy crap off the internet care a lot about this. So how could you transmit information secretly? Well, here's an idea that would have seemed cool when you were in third grade. It's called the Caesar cipher. Supposedly, apocryphally, Julius Caesar invented this one. If you wanted to write hello world, you just take H and you map it to the next letter of the alphabet, I. E goes to F, blah, 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 right? Looks totally gibberishy. At this point, in third grade, that would have probably worked pretty well. At this point, I'm fairly confident that given a long enough text encrypted this way, any of you could figure out in, at most an hour or so, how to decrypt that text. So the idea is you don't know how many has been added, right? Maybe I add 3 instead of 1, et cetera. So the project, when you're, bored tonight and don't have anything to do because there's no shopping in Waterloo, see if you can figure out how you would decrypt a Caesar cipher if you didn't know how much I had added. You'll find that while doing a Caesar cipher is quite easy, and it's easy to understand, it's convenient to do, and it is completely and totally insecure. This is not something that the CIA is going to use. Something the CIA does use, however, is called a one-time pad. This is a way of sending secure information that is absolutely secure. It is only vulnerable to what we call rubber hose decryption. Does anybody know what rubber hose decryption is? You find the guy who sent the message and you beat him with a rubber hose until he tells you what the message was. We've reached the point, honestly, where this is essentially the major weakness in most of today's crypto systems, with one big exception. But this is how most codes are broken. They're not broken by decrypting the code, because we're really good at cryptography. They're broken by some sort of nasty end-user attack where you literally, you know, peer over the decryptor's shoulder or the sender's shoulder or something like that. Social engineering as opposed to computational engineering. So a one-time pad, to do this, the sender and the receiver both have to share a string of random bits. Typically the way they do this at the NSA, for instance, is they put up an antenna to record atmospheric noise. Then they jumble that up even more. And then they blit it onto a CD-ROM, so you get 600 megabytes of random noise. You make two copies of it, and you send one of them over to Afghanistan, and it goes in the embassy there, and you keep one of them in Washington, D.C. I guess that should be Ottawa in Canada now. Yeah. Okay. Does Canada have an NSA or an equivalent? CIS? Okay, right. And now this conversation is being tapped, I'm sure, now that we've said that. So you get two copies, and what you do is you just flip, you do an XOR, you flip every bit in the message depending on what the bit in the key is. And then this looks like complete and total gibberish. It's information theoretically provably gibberish, random, unless you happen to have the secret key, and so you just decrypt at the other end. This is easy to understand. Awkward to do because you have to FedEx a CD over there, and oops, what happens if somebody looks at it along the way? So they send these things in diplomatic pouches, which are protected by the theory that the guy carrying the diplomatic pouch is, first of all, legally immune to being, like, you know, searched, and B, not going to fall asleep. How much do you want to bet on that? So you really need to trust, you need a lot of coffee, otherwise the guy falls asleep and somebody steals his message. So this is sort of awkward to do in practice, but it is absolutely secure. Because it's awkward to do in practice, we don't use it on, for instance, to interwebs. So what we do use is a cool thing called public key cryptography, invented by three guys named R, S, and A. I think they had longer parts to their names, but I don't remember them. And I'm not even going to try to explain how this works. The idea is that there is an encryption key, a public key. Everybody knows this one, and you can use it to encrypt a message. And then there's a private key that decrypts the message. So the idea is kind of like a standard padlock here, right? You got a padlock. If it's open, anybody can lock it. Very easy. Once it's locked, you need the key to unlock it. So it's kind of like taking a bunch of padlocks that all have the same key, mailing them to all your friends, and saying, send me a package and padlock it with this padlock. They don't have to have the key, as long as you send it to them open, to lock the lock. But once it's locked, nobody can unlock it without the key. For RSA, which is this, up until very recently, was a standard used for initiating transactions with Amazon.com, for instance, pretty much everywhere on the internet, the public key is a product of two very large prime numbers, like, you know, 200 digits each. And the private key is the two numbers themselves. And as you might recall from the previous slide, I pointed out that multiplying is easy, but factoring is really hard. And so this algorithm is complex, but it's very convenient because you don't need to share the private key. I can keep my private key right here, and I can wear my tinfoil hat, and all you can send me messages nonetheless. It is computationally secure, which is to say, to break this, we know exactly how to break this. Just factor the number. Problem is, it's really hard. So until somebody wants to take the time, say 600 million years, to factor one of these numbers, it's secure. So, brief survey of cryptography. So that's it for information theory. I hope I've given you an idea of what the information theory problems that we quantum information people came in and started looking at are. And there haven't really been that many questions. I feel like I've stunned you into submission or something. Does anybody need a cup of coffee? Yes. But let's make it like a 1 minute coffee break, okay? If anybody wants a cup, is that okay, Richard? Okay. If anybody wants a cup of coffee, go get one, because I want you fired up. But hurry back, okay? I'm not kidding here. I will start telling jokes. Sorry, I didn't do my jacket. We might have access as far as I know, so it doesn't make a darn bit of difference for that. The reason I'm asking is about a distribution of my knowledge. The only extra way not to do this is they're both numbers here. And they both have to do with prime numbers. But it still needs to give us a help, even in testing whether a particular number is prime. Now, it turns out we ask because the Fed's figure for primes isn't really the key, which means testing primality is actually more easily problem. We were really good at testing whether a number was prime, but we weren't sure if they were the hard ones. The same number that are in the parts. So it's not even a conjecture. It's the only conjecture is can it be built on the computer?
Yeah.
I'm not arguing that there's no conjecture that it can't. So, what is it? That about it. I can go on.
Thank you. would say it's an expression.
No. It really is. No. Okay, so I think there's a couple of people still trickling in, which means,
well, they're going to miss out. Bummer being them. But on the other hand, they're going to have coffee, so that's a plus. So part two here, how quantum makes this stuff different, and in particular, what the heck is quantum? So the short version is nature is weirder than we thought, at least weirder than we thought it was back in 1900 and weirder than most people think it is today. This came as a shock in the early bits of the 1900s. There are a bunch of experimental symptoms that, in fact, nature is weirder than we thought, although some of these seem weird themselves. According to classical physics, atoms should collapse and spew out lots of radiation. They shouldn't be stable. So that was a problem with classical physics. Classical physics also predicts that light would be either little chunks, corpuscles, as Newton thought, or waves, as Huygens thought, both back in the 1600s. And it turns out that there's experimental evidence that light comes in chunks, and there's experimental evidence that light comes in waves, which really confused the heck out of people. So this is a problem with classical physics because it simply makes no sense. And there's another one with classical physics, it turns out, predicts that glowing charcoal, black bodies, should radiate infinite amounts of energy. But they don't. Otherwise, every time you barbecued, you'd be in serious trouble. So all of these things were predicted by classical physics, and people scratched their heads and said, well, I guess there must be something wrong. Either we did the math wrong, that happens all the way through your career, or there's something wrong with the assumptions. It turns out there was something wrong with the assumptions. We expected physical systems to follow certain rules, and actually they follow different rules. For instance, statements that we thought were true, like if I have a particle, then it has a position and it has a momentum, and they describe where it's going and where it is. Well, that's not technically true. You cannot say that it simultaneously has a position and a momentum, and if you did, then you would end up in a contradiction with experimental evidence. However, statements that we didn't think to be true, for instance, that a particle of light has to have an energy, which is an integer multiple of its frequency, sort of the energy of light beams is quantized, if you will. This turned out to be true, even though we didn't think. So the point is that there were weird rules. Once we started experimentally figuring out these rules, we built a new framework for what nature is actually like. And the, to me, core observation is that we needed to redefine the states in which physical systems can be found. In other words, the language that we use to describe physical systems. So let me explain what I mean by states of physical systems. Here's a physical system you're probably familiar with. It's a pendulum. So here's the pendulum, and you'll notice it's swinging back and forth, but it's sort of getting damped out. There's some friction in this pendulum. This is just going to go over and over again. So this is a damped pendulum. The state of this pendulum, the point of a state is to describe everything about the system that I need to know in order to predict what it's going to do next. So if you were going to write down a state for this simple idealized pendulum, and I'll give you a hint, I'll give you a crib here, which is things that do not change ever, like the mass of the pendulum or the length of the string, are not included in the state. They are just assumed as constants, right? So we don't have to put those in the state because they never change. What would you write down on a piece of paper to completely describe the state of this pendulum at an instant of time? Okay. I heard the words out of the well there. Yes, I would need to write down its position. Where is the pendulum at that instant? But that's not enough, because if I just know where it is, I don't know where it's going. And I also need to write down where it's going, what its momentum is. So here is a two-dimensional plot with two numbers. Here's position. Here's momentum, or mass times velocity. I'm not going to explain why we like momentum better than velocity. And as the pendulum swings here, you've probably noticed a point is tracing out a line in this, it's called phase space, just a term for a plot. Phase space is where the states of particle systems live. Yes, sir?
Ah, good question.
Because I worked this off of somebody's site on the internet, and that's how they made it. If I were to speculate on why they put the arrows there, the arrows are flow lines. They, in fact, tell you if the particle is at this point in phase space, if this is its state, then the arrow tells you where the state will move to next. So the state changes over time, right? And those arrows just tell me from each point, where will it go? Now, here's a deep question. Why is it that for a pendulum or any other single particle system, I need two and only two real numbers, not one and not three? Why is position not enough, and why do I not need three?
This pendulum's moving in two dimensions.
Actually, this pendulum is, so if the length of that string is fixed, so it moves on a circle.
But time, too.
So there is time, but nonetheless, for a one degree of freedom system, it's not actually as simple as just because there's one position and one time. There, it could be otherwise. So the cool kind of, you know, thing to think about maybe as you're going to sleep at night, okay, maybe you have other things to think about. The reason you need two is because Newton's laws are second order differential equations. They've got a second derivative in them. F equals ma, right? A is acceleration. It's the second derivative of position. That's what's going on here, F equals ma. It turns out that the reason you need exactly two numbers, position and momentum, is because that's a second-order equation, second-order differential equation. Kind of cool, kind of deep, or you could just forget about it. Okay, so the point that I'm making is that the state of a pendulum is a point in this phase space. It could be here. It could be here. It could be here. The set of all points in this plane going off to infinity constitutes the set of possible states for that physical system. There are a lot of those states. So let me go to a slightly simpler example. Example number two is going to be the simplest thing I can possibly think of, which is a switch. This is going to be an idealized switch. It has two positions, on and off. We're not going to talk about any in-between positions. It's kind of like a coin, right? If you learn about probability, coins are always heads or tails. And if you ask questions like, well, what if it comes off edge? Your math teacher says, there's no edge here. No edge. Just on and off. Two states. I'm going to label those states, because I'm talking about information theory, 0 and 1, for no particular reason. I just like those names. And then I'm going to draw a little diagram. So I'm going to do some geometry here. And I want you, one key fact. I'm going to confuse you on this slide. Oh, by the way, the reason I sent you to get coffee is this is the pedagogical bit. This is the part where you might actually learn something as opposed to just hear cool stories. So turn on the brain. You don't have to take notes, but turn on the brain, turn on the eyes. Now, the reason I'm going to confuse you on this slide is I am going to use three different notions of geometry, and they're all totally uncorrelated. So do not make the mistake of thinking that this geometrical picture here has anything to do with the geometrical picture that I'm about to show you. Clear your mind. Okay. So in the new geometry I'm talking about, here is my one state. This means, the second geometrical picture is edge, right? It's the idea that in between on and off, there could be a sort of an edge of the coin, right? But remember, we said that those don't exist. This is an idealized switch that just has on and off. So, okay, here's the one state. And I'm going to put the off state here. So this is just a set of two states. It could be on, it could be off. Those are the states for this system. Very easy, right? And now I'm going to confuse it completely by claiming that there are other states too. Even though I just said those are the only two states. Oh, three. I'm going to claim that there are states all in between here. And you're saying to yourself, didn't you just say there weren't any states in between on and off? That's why they're totally different geometrical pictures. This state in the middle does not represent edge. These red states here are what I would call probabilistic states, or states of knowledge. They are not distinct places the switch can be. They are things I could know about the switch. Suppose that I took the switch and I went toggle, 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 toggle. And I kept toggling it until you couldn't see it. And I hit it behind my back and I said, is the switch on or off? You could say on, but you might be wrong. You could say off, but you might be wrong. What could you say and not be wrong? Thank you. Sound of one hand clapping, right? Okay, you could say it is a switch. That's actually a very good point. Frighteningly deep, actually, but I'm not going to go there. Probably on. So you think you know that I'm an on kind of guy. You think it's more probable that I'm going to leave it on. But you know, you might be wrong there, too. What you could say is, I don't know. I assign probability one half to it being on and probability one half to it being off. So where'd my chalk go? So the way I could represent that state of knowledge is I could say probability of on, 50%, probability of off is equal to 50%. And I could represent this by a probability distribution, which looks like a vector in what I'll call probability space, which is to say it's just a list of numbers. Now, suppose that you thought that I was an on kind of a guy and that it was probably on. How might you represent that?
Make the one with the number on top higher and the one on the bottom lower.
Okay. So I could say, here is another description of my knowledge about this system.
Could you do like a greater than symbol?
I could.
So you don't have any specific numbers.
Yeah. It's a good question and a great idea, and I'm so tempted to go off on a half-hour digression about, ooh, isn't probability theory cool, and this and that and the other thing, and I'm just going to refrain, and I'm going to say, great point, moving on. the slightly longer answer is, there are reasons to not talk about knowledge of knowledge. These things tell me how much I know about the system. What you're saying is maybe you're even uncertain about how much you know about the system. And this gets recursively weird, and I'm not going to go there. So for the moment, I'm going to assume that I know how much I don't know about the system. So this would be probably on. And, of course, now I've drawn a geometric representation of all of these probability distributions. In general, I can have probabilistic states that look like this, where you put any number, x, between 0 and 1 in there. And now I can represent all, so x equals 1 would give me 1 and 0, which tells me I am positive that it's on. X equals 0 gives me I am positive that it's off. So there are all of these states that I'm going to put these in between here. Here's 1 comma 0, here's 0 comma 1, here's a half. That's it. There we go. Probably off, probably on, and I have no idea. As far as I know, it's random. These are the probabilistic states, the states of knowledge for a system. And they're very useful. Don't make the mistake of thinking that these states are, you know, they imply that the switch could be halfway on, halfway off. What they imply is that you don't know whether it's on or off. So what I've just done, can you go ahead and go away? Thank you very much. So starting with some states of reality, I've then filled in the gap in between with states of knowledge. And this is very useful for information theory because frequently we want to be able to talk about bits that we don't know exactly whether they're on or off. We want to deal with uncertainty because noise produces uncertainty. So this is part of the formalism in information theory, and these are the states of classical systems. Now, what can happen to a classical system? Answer is simple. The states of reality can get permuted among one another. In other words, if I have this switch, I could flip it. If I flip the switch, 0 becomes 1 and 1 becomes 0. So I've just flipped these two.
And the interior just comes along for the ride. If it was probably on before I flipped it, it becomes probably off. Now, here's a cool semi-deep thing that I'm just going to skip over. If you imagine all the points in here, every single point, there's a lot of them, right? Infinitely many, uncountably infinitely many, aleph one of them. If you don't know what that means, please don't worry about it. The dynamics, the reversible dynamics, the non-frictiony dynamics of any physical system are in fact just a permutation, a reshuffling of those physical states. This is the cool thing about classical mechanics that, for instance, I can rotate this around, that's what a pendulum does, or I could, you know, move it from side to side or whatever, or I could do other weirder reshufflings. But if the dynamics are reversible, there's no friction, there's no information loss, then I just permute all of these points in here. But now I'm permuting infinitely many things, so it gets a little bit weird. So these are the dynamics of classical systems. Okay, why am I explaining this? Because now I'm going to jump to actual quantum mechanics. And I want to explain very briefly a rather cool thing that Lucian Hardy here at the Perimeter Institute did about 5 years ago. He sat down and he asked, could somebody in 1850, long before any experimental evidence for quantum mechanics, could they have deduced quantum mechanics? Could they have said, wait, there's something wrong, even before they saw the evidence? By the way, Einstein did this. Einstein figured out general relativity before anybody knew that there was actually anything wrong with Newtonian gravitation. That was pretty cool. String theorists today claim, they believe that they are doing this, that they are figuring out the true nature of reality, that it's all strings, before there's any experimental evidence for string theory. Of course, there's a big debate about whether string theory is right or not even wrong, and I'm not going to get into that. But there is a long history of people, theorists, figuring out things before there's any evidence. So what Lucian asked is, even though we didn't in this case, could we? Lucian said, let me demand one axiom. Between any pair of states, I am going to demand that there be dynamical transformations that are reversible. In other words, there's no friction or anything. And they are continuous, smooth, as opposed to jumpy, discrete. So if I look at the picture that I just drew with these classical states for a switch or a bit, there's one and there's zero, the problem is that this probabilistic bit, there's not enough intermediate states for it to move smoothly from one to zero. You can only jump there discontinuously. Now, somebody in the room, I guarantee you, probably you, is thinking, can I just go through here? Which is a very good idea. Wrong, but good. Anybody want to guess why you can't just have a smooth transition that goes through here? What would be wrong with that? So, yes?
Could some of those numbers be irrational?
Sorry?
Could some of those numbers be irrational?
Ah, that's a cool idea. They are. That's not the answer. You would go through actually all of them. Essentially, all of those numbers are irrational. But that's still okay. You could have a trajectory that just went through here. Yes?
Is it possible that one is going to overlap at some point?
Sorry? So it's an interesting thought, but no, it's not that one and zero overlap. They are totally distinguishable, like a light switch. And in a way, it's because these states are discrete, but I've put it, there's a continuous family of states of uncertainty in between. Here's the reason that I can't just say, well, there's a continuous reversible dynamical transformation from one to zero through the middle. What happens when I get halfway to the middle here? I know nothing. I'm random, right? If I know nothing about the state, how do I know which way I was going? I would need some sort of extra parameter that told me I was going from zero, from one to zero, or from zero to one. It's sort of like going to the grocery store if you have really bad amnesia, right? You get halfway to the grocery store and you're like, was I going to the grocery store or was I going home? I can't remember. Do I have milk? What was I looking for? Right? This is the problem. There are simply not enough intermediate states here to allow continuous transformations. The only way you can do it is in one swell swoop, bonk, jump from zero to one. So Lucian said, what if we demand? Well, we need to add more states. If we take this as a universal law of nature, then we're going to have some more states accessible to the particle. So, for instance, we could have a path that went like this. And notice that I've just added in a whole bunch more states here. What do those states mean? What do they do? I don't know yet. I've just sort of drawn a nice smooth path, and I've kept them all far away from this maximally random state. So I want to argue that they're in some sense non-random. By the way, if at this point you start feeling that you're gripping my explanation, you know, by your fingernails for dear life, and it's not entirely making sense, don't worry about that. I honestly don't know of a way to make quantum mechanics make sense in a short period of time. What I'm trying to do is give a flavor. Feel free to be skeptical. Feel free to, you know, point out that this doesn't all entirely hang together. Anyway, moving on. So we need some way to have this path. But then, remember, we also need to be able to go back from 0 to 1, because we could flip that way. So we need even more states. And the core idea of Lucien's argument is that in order to have continuous smooth transformations, we keep having to add more states that didn't exist in our classical picture of nature. Then a whole bunch of cool math happens, and we discover that, in fact, there have to be even more states than this for the whole thing to be mathematically consistent. This is nice, juicy theoretical physics, and I'm going to jump directly to the answer, which is it turns out that the simplest and practically the only theory that satisfies this axiom is quantum mechanics itself. And in quantum mechanics, which I'm now going to tell you about, having tried to vaguely motivate it this way, in addition to the light switch being on and being off, there is a whole sphere, not just a circle, but a sphere of other states, states that are states of certainty. In other words, they're not probabilistic states. And they all, in some sense, exist. And so quantum states, and this is the absolute core of quantum information theory, is the structure of the states. What states can a bit, if it is a quantum bit, a system with two states available to it, a light switch, if you will, what are the states that it can be in? So here is a graphical representation of all of those states. Before I had my classical bit with state 1 here and state 0 here and a bunch of probabilistic, I don't know, states in between. Now I have 1 up here and 0 here. And I've put this funny symbol called a ket around it, which is nothing more and nothing less than language saying, this is a quantum state. It's the quantum 1 and the quantum 0. Did you end up covering that at all?
Yeah. I mentioned it, but.
OK, well, there you go. I've just covered it. And then there are all these other states over here and over here and on the opposite pole of the sphere, the east pole and the west pole and all that jazz. And I'm not going to go into the math, but if you've had a little bit of linear algebra, then I can the total structure of this state space turns out to be, if I start by knowing I have two distinguishable states like on and off, then I can take linear, I think of those as basis vectors in a vector space, and then I can take linear combinations of them, like which are called superpositions. So if I think of this state as representing a live cat and this one as a dead cat, this one is Schrodinger's cat. This one is Schrodinger's other cat. And the freaky thing is that both Schrodinger's cat and Schrodinger's other cat are equally probable to be dead and alive if I ask whether it's dead or alive. So if I ask whether it's dead or alive, then I can't tell the difference between Schrodinger's cat and Schrodinger's other cat. But the freaky thing is that there are, in fact, two different ones. And if I ask the right question, then I can tell the difference between what's called a positive superposition, where I've added these two equally with a plus sign, and a negative superposition where I've added them equally with a minus sign. That should be considered sort of extracurricular. If you've had linear algebra, that might have made sense. If it didn't, just So what does this mean? Well, the key thing is that a state is supposed to predict the outcome of measurements on the system. So a brief digression on quantum measurements, the sole purpose of a state is to predict the outcome of measurements. So if I have all of these extra states, why are they there? Well, to predict some measurements, there must be new measurements. Just as there are new states of matter that we didn't think existed before quantum mechanics, there must also be new measurements that we can make that will detect the difference between those two states. Because if I had two states and I could never detect the difference between them, well, they're basically the same state, right? So it turns out, I'll state this without proof, that just by asymmetry, just as I could measure is the light switch on or off, every axis along this sphere represents a different one-bit question I could ask of the system. I could ask, is the light switch left or right? Except that left and right here do not mean anything about, like, you know, physically cocked this way or cocked that way. There's no edge. It's a totally new property of nature because it's represented by states that didn't exist in our previous conception of light switches. Of course, this is only true for really, really small light switches. If you have big light switches, then it turns out that there's a thing called decoherence that makes everything look really classical. And it basically takes this sphere and it grinds it down, if you will, to that sort of classical core consisting of just on, off, and I don't know. This is called the Bloch sphere. It represents all of the states available to a quantum bit. And you know what? I'm going to skip over this bit about quantum measurements, except to point out that the meaning of it, well, okay, I'm not going to skip over it. If I measure whether the light switch is on or off, up or down, and the state of the light switch is, say, cocked at an angle to this direction, then I will get a random outcome, but with particular probabilities. So in this state, for instance, I will get up with 95% probability and down with 5% probability. By measuring the system, I then collapse its state into one of the two alternatives that I actually measured. So if I'm in the left state of a quantum light switch and I ask the light switch, are you up or are you down? By, for instance, looking at it, then the answer will be either up or down with, in this case, 50-50 probability. And once I've measured it, if I measure it again immediately afterwards, then it will still be in the state that I measured it originally in. No funny business here. Which means that if I find it up, then the state afterward is up. And this is what's called collapse of the wave function. Okay, so what's the point of all this quantum state crap? Here's the key question that quantum information science asks. What can we do using these new rules that we couldn't do before? Back in 1850, if there had been information theory, we would have thought that all systems were classical and all of our communication, for instance, had to go on using classical light switches or classical, you know, well, things. But now we know that there are these new states available. Oh, cool. It's like you played all your life with Tinker Toys and suddenly somebody introduces you to Legos. Wow. Okay, we've got Legos. What can we do with Legos? Or to make a better example, when you guys started learning biology, how many kingdoms were there? Three, five, all the odd numbers? Okay, so I'm an old fart. So when I learned biology, there were three kingdoms, animal, vegetable, and mineral. Not mineral. Animals, plants, and fungi. And then we decided that actually bacteria were a kingdom of their own. And so were amoebas. Those were the protists. And then we decided that bacteria were actually two kingdoms, or maybe three. And last time I checked, nobody knew how many kingdoms there were. Nope. What's that? Is it seven? I thought there might be 11. Okay, seven. Cool. You guys are the experts. Point is, one of the advantages of discovering all these new organisms is that there are now things we can do with them. We're like, hey, maybe we could take some of these archaea that we didn't know existed before, and we could genetically modify them to, like, eat oil or something like that, because we have too much oil. But that's when you get oil spills and that sort of thing. So new things create confusion. I only had to remember three kingdoms, and I still got them wrong. You guys have to remember seven, and I'm so sorry. On the other hand, they create new possibilities. So these new quantum states created confusion, but they also created new possibilities. So what can we do with them? Here's a cool example. A new kind of cryptography. So if you are a cryptographic kind of information theorist, then your favorite two words after 0 and 1 are Alice and Bob. So the way this works, the way it always works, is that Alice sends a message to Bob. And they want to accomplish something. They want to communicate, or they want to communicate securely, or they want to do whatever. In this particular case, Alice wants to send a message to Bob. And she does not want Eve, the evil eavesdropper, who's somewhere in the middle here, to be able to read her message.
This is cryptography. So quantum cryptography, this is a basic setup. Now I'm going to get rid of these pretty pictures. Sorry, Bob. And go back to the hardcore quantum state sphere here. How can we use these quantum states to send information securely? OK, here's how it works. Hang on for dear life, because I'm going to go through this fairly fast, because I've got not very much time left, and I want to cover some cool stuff. OK, first of all, these pairs of states are called bases for the state space. Alice is going to pick a random one of them, either up, down, left, right, or in, out. Right? So first of all, she picks one of those three directions. Then, if she wants to send Bob a zero, then she sends up or left or in, depending on which of the three pairs she picked. If she wants to send a one, she sends down or right or out. Now, there is a measurement that Bob could make that would distinguish up from down perfectly. But Bob doesn't know yet which one Alice picked. So Bob just flips a three-sided coin. Think about that. How do you make a three-sided coin? It's kind of freaky. Anyway, Bob picks a random basis, and he measures it. Now, two-thirds of the time, he picks the wrong basis. So for instance, Alice sends this state up. She's trying to send a one bit. And Bob measures, was it left or was it right? If Alice sent up and Bob measures, was it left or was it right, what result does Bob get? OK. Well, I thought I heard somebody say nothing in particular. And that's exactly correct. He gets a random result. That quick slide on quantum measurement was pointing out that if he measures this, he just gets 50-50 probabilities of either one, which is useless, because that then tells him nothing about what was sent. But one-third of the time, he measures the right basis. He gets lucky. And then he just records what he gets. And then afterward, after they've done this a million times or so, Alice calls Bob up on the phone, which is not secure. The CIS can be eavesdropping on the phone. And Alice says, OK, first of all, I sent up or down. And then I sent up or down again. And then I sent left or right. And then I sent up or down again. And then I sent in and out. And then I sent left and right, blah, blah. She tells him what basis she sent each bit in. And Bob goes through, and he says, uh-huh. And he tells Alice, OK, I measured correctly on bits number 1, 3, 17, 19, et cetera. He gives her a list of which ones. Now, neither of them ever communicated the actual bit. All they talked about on the public line was, what basis did you send? Didn't say whether it was up or down, just that it was up or down, as opposed to left or right. And then Bob says, yep, I measured the right thing. So they've never communicated to the evil eavesdropper what any of the data was. But they now have, since Bob knows which bits were correct, they now share a secret key. And in other words, they agree on the first bit is 0, the second bit is 1, the third bit is 0, et cetera, once they've thrown away the two-thirds that were wrong. Now, if they now share a secret key, they can do one-time pad cryptography. Alice can encrypt her message using her half of the secret key that they share, send it over the phone. The CIS will have no idea what's going on. And then Bob decrypts it at his end. We have bootstrapped our way from Alice and Bob never having met each other to them sharing a secret key that they can use to do one-time pad cryptography. Now, they need a phone line, but that phone line can be totally public. I mean, Alice could stand up on top of a tower and shout it for all we care. So why is this secure? Here's the reason that this is secure. It has to do with the fact that quantum measurements collapse quantum states. In other words, if the eavesdropper listens in, then she's going to measure some of these things. But two-thirds of the time, she's going to measure the wrong basis. So Alice will send, for instance, the left state. And the eavesdropper will say, OK, I'm going to try for this bit. And two-thirds of the time, she'll measure up, down, or in, out. And when she does, she will collapse the state into one of those two states. She'll change the state. There's no way to measure in quantum mechanics without changing the state, unless you know what basis to measure in. And Eve doesn't know what basis to measure in. The simple answer is because quantum mechanics doesn't let you. The measurements that exist, the ones that can be made, are the ones along lines like this. You can't measure all three at once. You could make a measurement that has all six of these as possible outcomes. But the only way it turns out to do it
is to flip a three-sided coin and then measure one of these. And obviously, there is some probability that you could get any of these as outcomes. The key thing here is that when you measure the state, even if you make that measurement, you end up disturbing it. And at the moment, I'm simply going to say that as sort of by fiat, this is a fact about the world. I'm not going to try to explain it. Part of the reason is it's kind of a deep problem. We don't really understand it super well. We just know that it's true. And all the experiments we've done indicate that it's true. And I'd love to have a simple explanation. But I apologize. I'm not going to be able to give you one right now. Turns out you can't do that measurement. If we ever figured out a way to do that measurement, it would break quantum cryptography. But we have very strong reasons for believing that it's impossible. So the short version is, Alice and Bob can detect disturbance because Bob gets a different answer from Alice some of the time, and they compare a small number of their good bits. So this is one application. I am pretty close to out of time, so let me zip forward, and I'm just going to skip some stuff here. Quantum dynamics, the dynamical transformations are rotations around any axis. For instance, I could rotate around these x, y, and z axes, and you know what? Let's skip this. Cool stuff, blah, blah, blah. The point of this slide is that I'm arguing there is a certain set of transformations on a bunch of qubits that if you have a classical computer, you can just follow along. You know what transformations are being done. You can keep track of it on a classical computer. It doesn't take you very long. This is considered to be remarkable. It has a name. It's called the Gottesman-Knell theorem. The question is, why is this remarkable? Why is it remarkable that for a particular set of 90-degree rotations on qubits, you can simulate it efficiently on a classical computer? The reason this is remarkable is that, in general, you can't. If you have, say, 100 qubits, and you allow them to evolve according to some totally known and understood dynamical map, there is no efficient way to predict what will happen using a classical computer. You can predict it, but it takes a really long time. And this is the core idea behind quantum computation. So Feynman, back in 1982, pointed out that if you built a computer out of 100 quantum bits, then you could use that to simulate quantum systems because it is itself a quantum system. Basically, you just mock up the quantum system that you want to simulate. So this computer built out of qubits can do something that classical computers can't. And this was the core observation that made us say, would a quantum computer built out of qubits be more powerful than a classical computer? And so who here is familiar with Slashdot? OK, all right. So it's a news site on the internet. It grabs news stories from all over the place. It's focused on computer people, IT people, news for nerds, stuff that matters, is, I believe, the mantra. Bunch of you know, really knowledgeable IT professionals, and they get all excited every time something comes up about quantum computing, and they post a story, and then like 600 geeks jump on and say, oh, quantum computers are going to change the entire world. Oh my god, they can solve everything in instant time. OK, so the question is a quantum computer just a totally awesome kick-butt supercomputer? Well, here's what a quantum computer is. It's a bunch of qubits that you protect from noise and on which you can do operations on just pairs of them. This turns out to be enough to do anything that you can do with a bunch of qubits. It's enough to just be able to do one and two qubit operations because you kind of chain them together. And what can you do with such a device? You can solve some hard problems. For instance, you can simulate quantum systems. Interestingly, you can factor very large numbers very fast. It's called Shor's algorithm. It is the primary reason that we are getting funded at a clip of about $500 million a year, because the National Security Agency in the US would really like to factor large numbers. Anybody know why? OK, good. You do remember the first part of the talk. Yes, if you can factor numbers fast, which you cannot do on a classical computer as far as we know, you can break RSA crypto. They would like to do that. So they want to build a quantum computer. Factoring is not that inherently interesting a problem. There are a few others. But this is the big one, and this is the other big one. And so in fact, can a quantum computer solve all hard problems? No. I'm not going to go into detail on this, but actually there's surprisingly few hard problems that we know that a quantum computer can solve. This is almost it, and then there's half a dozen others that you've never heard of. So they are not all-purpose supercomputers. They cannot solve NP-complete problems. We don't know what they can do, and that's an active field of research. And final question, will a quantum computer run regular software really fast? Is this going to really kick butt on, like, you know, Quake 17? No. Let me explain why. It has to do with this line, protected from noise. A quantum computer is very fragile. It needs to be protected. So it's a picture of a local inventor who's created a paste that if you, it's a heat protection paste. You can see he's putting a blowtorch on his hand with a thin tile of this paste in between. This is an example of how to protect, you know, this is a quantum computer. Then this would protect from nasty thermal noise. But this is not a good metaphor. This is not enough protection. Quantum computers are much more fragile than that. Let me make this guy a little bit smaller. Then what you want to think of is this is what you're trying to protect from. They are really fragile. This guy is a little bit better known for actually a project involving grizzly bears. Before he got into this thing, he built something called the bear suit. So this is the first model of the bear suit. It's a bunch of hockey gear. The idea is to protect a human being from a grizzly bear. So over time, this is a metaphor for what's going on in quantum information. We are building better and better bear suits to protect our fragile quantum computer from the nasty grizzly bears of decoherence. And you'll notice that his bear suits are getting better and better. And I mean, in fact, they do work pretty well. He's, you know. Gotta love the helmet. This is approximately what we're going to be doing for the next, you know, couple of decades. This is just down the road, actually. I've gone rock climbing there. This is what we call quantum prototyping. So I think there's a scene that's, yeah. Okay, I want you to notice how well he gets around. Just notice the walking business, and I'm going to come back to this in a minute. A little bit more staged than before. But so the point is, he has, like we hope to do, succeeded in building a very effective protection against hostile environments, if you will. Unfortunately, it's kind of reduced persistence. You'll notice it's reduced his mobility a little bit. This is the drawback of quantum computing, is that you need to protect it so effectively that it's like waddling around in a full suit of armor. They're going to have to run very slow because we're going to have to clothe them in so many layers of armor against the noise and the heat and the nasty stuff, decoherence, going on in the environment. As a result, they will be very ineffective at, say, running Word. They're not going to be faster than classical computers except at very specialized tasks. I had a third part to this on technologies that we're using. But you guys are going to see this afternoon. Richard, I'm essentially out of time, right? So let me, do I have 30 seconds? Okay. I said 30. I'm going to take 60. Here are some of the technologies that we're using to build baby quantum computers. Photons are, you might say, the ideal qubit. They're controllable. They don't interact with things very much. These are various experiments. We can either have photons in free space in laser beams, or we can trap them in little cavities between mirrors, or we can even use microwave photons that travel along waveguides in chips to communicate between other quantum systems. This is so far very valuable for prototyping. It's doubtful whether we'll ever be able to build an all-photon quantum computer. The technology you'll see the most of over at IQC is photonic stuff and also nuclear magnetic resonance, where the qubits live on complex molecules. There are 7 qubits on this molecule. The rest of the atoms are useless. They're addressed by sending radio frequency pulses into a huge magnetic NMR spectrometer. And the Shor's algorithm was used on this molecule to factor the number 15. Extra credit to anybody who can factor 15. It cost them about $1 million. We're prototyping. NMR is pretty much doomed in the long term. We just can't get enough qubits because you can't make big enough molecules. We are pretty excited about using single atoms trapped in a lattice of laser beams called an atomic lattice. Or one of the most promising technologies right now, where they've got 8 qubits up and running and it looks scalable, can be made bigger, is ion traps, where you've got a tiny little magnetic trap inside of a huge vacuum chamber. And these are actual photographs of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 ions trapped in there. And we can control each one of them as an individual quantum system. Maybe the most promising technology eventually, even though we really haven't gotten it up and running yet, is SQUID, superconducting quantum interference devices. A SQUID is a little ring of superconductor. And if you put a current in a superconductor, then you get a magnetic field that just sits there. It's like an electromagnet that never spins down. And by putting little gaps here called Josephson junctions, you can get these things to have quantized flux levels. And you can control them like a qubit. There's exactly 1 quantum of flux or -1 quantum of flux going through the middle. So here's an electron micrograph of exactly such a thing. These are some of the technologies that we hope we will be able to build in somewhere between 10 and 30 years into a functioning quantum computer. Some of these are already being used, especially the photonics, for doing quantum cryptography, the other application that I mentioned. And we really don't know what might be possible. So I will leave you with a brief list of the actual research fronts, the things that we are working actively on and probably will be for the next 30 years. Thanks for your time.
Time for just a couple of questions, just 2 quick questions.
Is that your hand or just scratching your head? Okay. Yes.
Could you talk more about the different types of quantum computer that can avoid the decoherence form? Like, for example, I thought topological quantum computer can actually avoid the breakdown.
Did Steve Fournier tell you to ask me that? One of my colleagues told me yesterday that he was going to tell you guys to ask me about topological quantum computer. Okay. This is one of the, I will be at lunch. Come up to me at lunch, ask me more detailed questions. But that's a cool one, so I'm going to take as much time as Richard gives me, minus 1 more question worth of time, to explain basically what this is. Topological quantum computing is one of the possible technologies that I didn't mention because that we don't have them in the lab yet. It's totally ultra-geek cool, though. I mean, this is the sort of thing that even, you know, professionals in quantum computing get all, like, geeked out about. Topological quantum computing is a way of designing a quantum system that is extraordinarily immune to noise. And essentially, the reason is that it's very hard to see the information for you. And therefore, the environment can't see the qubit either, and therefore can't screw it up. And the way that we build these things is using something called the fractional quantum Hall effect, which is something that happens if you take a thin, thin layer of metal. There's an electron fluid in metals. They act like water that conducts electricity. If you make this very thin, you have a 2-dimensional fluid. And then you put this thing in a very big magnetic field, and this fluid takes on the properties of a quantum field, kind of like superfluid helium, if you will, a little bit. And it becomes very still and quiescent. And it's possible to kick it and create a little bump in that field. It's called an excitation. And this particular field has the awesome property that if you take two bumps and you wind them around each other like this, the fluid remembers how many times you wound it around. You get, when you wind it like this, you would expect that you would get back to where you started from, but you don't. You sort of ratchet up. It's as if they have strings attached to them, and you were braiding those strings together. And there is some awesomely cool, freaky math about the braid group and the Jones polynomial that says that it turns out if you create enough of these excitations in a quantum Hall fluid, and then you go and you braid them all up, you can do a quantum computation. In fact, any quantum computation can be done this way, and it's phenomenally difficult for the environment to interfere with it. We are still at the negative second stage in the lab. We haven't even created one of these fluids yet. We think they exist, but we don't know for certain. Please come up to me at lunch. I'll be around. Sorry I took so much time with that question. I hope it was a cool answer. Thank you.